Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Fair Housing Act Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 8, 2016, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Bank of America Corporation v. City of Miami, which was consolidated with Wells Fargo & Co. v. City of Miami. In this case, the City of Miami sued Bank of America Corporation and similar defendants under the Fair Housing Act, arguing that the banks engaged in predatory lending practices that targeted minorities for higher risk loans, which resulted in high rates of default and caused financial harm to the city. Miami also alleged that the banks unjustly enriched themselves by taking advantage of benefits conferred by the city, thus denying the city expected property and tax revenues. The district court dismissed the FHA claims and held that Miami did not fall within the zone of interest the statute was meant to protect, and therefore lacked standing under the statute. The court also held that Miami had not adequately shown that the bank's conduct was the proximate cause of the harms the city claimed to have suffered. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit reversed, holding that FHA standing extends as broadly as Article 3 of the Constitution permits, that Miami had established Article 3 standing here, and that it had sufficiently alleged proximate causation. There are two questions now before the Supreme Court. One, whether by limiting suit to aggrieved persons, Congress required that a Fair Housing Act plaintiff plead more than just Article 3 injury in fact. And two, whether proximate cause requires more than just the possibility that a defendant could have foreseen that the remote plaintiff might ultimately lose money through some theoretical chain of contingencies. To discuss the case, we have Thea Brooke Knight, who is Associate Director of Financial Regulation Studies at the Cato Institute. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Knight.
Bank of America v. Miami is a case about housing finance and its connection to the Fair Housing Act. Miami has claimed that Bank of America and Wells Fargo engaged in discriminatory lending practices that led to higher-than-usual foreclosures among minority borrowers. These foreclosures, the city claims, have had a number of impacts on the city, including increasing urban blight, decreasing the city's tax base, and increasing expenses related to crime and other consequences of high vacancy neighborhoods. The question is whether the city has standing under the FHA to bring the claim. It's important to note that the appeal is of a motion to dismiss, not of a trial verdict. That is, the question is not whether the banks engaged in any particular practices, but only whether the city has standing to bring the claim under the FHA at all. Can a city recover for the financial effects of discriminatory practices? The FHA was enacted to curb discrimination in housing. There are certain types of actions that clearly fall within its ambit. For example, if someone was turned away from buying a house because of the buyer's race, there wouldn't really be much of a dispute that the buyer has standing to sue. Over the years, however, the court has held that the interests at stake under the statute extend beyond the prospective buyers and tenants. At the core of this case is the question of just how far the statute extends and who can bring a claim. The statute grants standing to, quote, any aggrieved person. This word aggrieved is the key. According to canons of construction and the rule against superfluity, we can't just read it out of the statute. It has to do some work. There's some language in earlier FHA cases to the effect that standing extends, quote, to the full extent of Article 3. These cases, however, predate a 1988 amendment to the FHA, which did not materially alter the definition of aggrieved. Since Congress amended the statute but did not change this language, it's reasonable to assume that Congress ratified judicial holdings interpreting that language. This was illustrated in an exchange between the Banks Council and Justice Kagan at oral argument. There's a question as to what exactly Congress ratified. The language stating that standing under the FHA extends to the full extent of Article 3 is arguably dicta. So was it actually ratified by Congress? So to understand this, let's look a little bit more closely at the cases that arguably Congress ratified. While aggrieved person clearly means this would-be buyer turned away due to race, it's also been held to include people more removed from the transaction. So, for example, in Traficante v. Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, residents of an apartment building brought suit alleging that their landlord had discriminated against non-whites. This, the residents claimed, had deprived them of the opportunities that living in a diverse building would provide. The court found that the tenants indeed had standing, reasoning that the statutory language evinces an intent on the part of Congress to define standing as broadly as is permitted by Article 3 of the Constitution. The court contrasted this case with the plaintiffs in Sierra Club v. Morton, noting that the tenants could articulate a personal injury or injury in fact, unlike the plaintiffs in Sierra Club. Then, just a few years later, the court revisited the question in Gladstone Realtors v. Village of Bellwood. In that case, the court found that the village itself had standing to sue based on its residents' loss of the same kinds of diversity opportunities that the Trafficante plaintiffs alleged. Again, these are not the people who were themselves discriminated against, but the residents of the neighborhood or of the building who wanted a more diverse community. The village claimed that realtors had steered buyers to different neighborhoods depending on race, and that this steering had resulted in less racial diversity in the village. So Trafficante established that municipalities as a whole have standing to sue under the FHA, while Gladstone established that those other than the person who is the direct victim of discrimination has standing. Each of these cases included language to the effect that standing under the FHA applies to the full extent of Article 3 of the Constitution. However, because the plaintiffs in each case had standing under even a more narrow definition of aggrieved person, the language is not essential to the holding and may be dicta. And in fact, the court recently rejected a position that would extend it, holding to the full extent of Article 3 of the Constitution, calling the language in these earlier cases ill-considered and declining to follow it. That case, Thompson v. North American Stainless, was not an FHA case, however. But it was a civil rights case, but it fell under Title VII, which addresses sex discrimination, and not under the FHA, or a title addressing racial discrimination. So, given the interest at stake in this case, it's not clear that the city has standing, even if, as a whole, municipalities can bring FHA claims. To look at another case, in Lexmark v. International Static Control, the court found that to recover under a statute, the plaintiff must fall within the zone of interest Congress was intending to protect when it enacted the law. Lexmark is also not an FHA case. It dealt with who has standing under the Lanham Act, but it's notable for its extensive treatment of the question of standing. And under Lexmark, stating an injury is only the first prong of the analysis when asserting a claim under a statute. The second prong is determining whether that type of injury was the type the Act was designed to address. And it's this second prong that's the crux of the current case. And this is clearly what hung up the court during oral argument. Increased foreclosures diminish a city's tax base, and therefore that is a harm that the city can allege. But if the only inquiry was whether the foreclosures led to a harm, the number of potential plaintiffs would be enormous. This seems to have been on several justices' minds. So Justice Sotomayor, for example, asked the city's counsel whether, under Miami's theory, a gardener could recover by claiming that he had fewer clients due to the increased foreclosures. And Chief Justice Roberts asked whether the utility company could recover for lost profits. And for both of these, counsel for the city answered no. The key, the attorney said, is property value. A realtor, for example, could recover because the decrease in property values would decrease potential commissions. But the gardener's harm is unconnected to any real property and so outside the bounds of the statute. To the extent that the FHA has been found to address harms such as those alleged in Gladstone or Trafficante, it seems that these are related to real property but not necessarily to property values. So I'm guessing that the city doesn't intend to make property values the only consideration, because tying the claim too closely or exclusively to property values could have uncomfortable consequences given the historical problem that the FHA was enacted to address, that is, homeowners fearing that because of racial prejudice, increased racial diversity risks driving down property values. Instead, cases like Gladstone and Trafficante seem to suggest the opposite, which is that increased diversity is a good and provides opportunities in and of itself. To get to the question that the court needs to actually answer, if the court were to fine for the city in this case, the court would probably have to articulate a rule that would permit Miami's suit, but not stretch it so far as to include every person who can state a loss related to increased foreclosures. So the probably there is because the court could just let standing extend to anyone who can assert a claim arising out of a discriminatory act, but it does seem unlikely the court would take it that far. So for one thing, such an interpretation would effectively read aggrieved out of the statute and would extend further than even the city has asked the court to go. It would presumably not include not only the gardener and the utility company we already discussed, but also individuals even further removed. So, for example, at oral argument, Justice Breyer asked what would happen if there were a journalist based in Alaska who wrote about successfully integrated neighborhoods whose livelihood was impacted by the lack of successful integration in Miami. The city's attorney responded that the journalist was too far removed to be included under the statute. But as Justice Breyer noted, the journalist's harm would be very much traceable to the discriminatory activity. So given the court's many questions about gardeners, utility companies, journalists in Alaska, in the Act's definition of a grieved person, and the city's refusal to include parties that are that far removed, it seems unlikely that the court is going to go that far. But overall, this line, which would separate the potential gardener from the city as a whole, is a very difficult one to draw. The bank's counsel conceded that there is a claim the city could articulate under the FHA. And this would be a claim that alleged a harm more like the harm claimed by the village of Bellwood. But this isn't the claim that the city of Miami pled. Instead, the city pled a financial harm. And when asked at oral argument to state the rule the city was advocating that the court adopt, the city's counsel alluded to this nexus to property value. So, in deciding the case, the question before the court will be whether the city's lost revenue from decreased property values is the type of injury that the statute was intended to protect against, and whether that is a sufficient limit to this definition of a grieved person.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.